coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Could Concord Mall in North Wilmington be the next mall to become a mere memory?
I think it can go on like this for a little while longer, but I don't think that it can go on like this indefinitely.
Contributor Eileen Delabrita looks at what's next for Concord Mall. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn what Delaware's HIV Consortium is doing to assist those living with HIV in the first state. Arts Playlist chats with Hagley Museum's executive director as she prepares to retire next year. And Enlighten Me highlights work at Christiana Care's Gene Editing Institute to improve lung cancer treatment. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Last week, a buzz was created when a sales listing appeared for Concord Mall in North Wilmington. Was the end near for the retail mainstay on Concord Pike that opened in the late 1960s? Its owner says not so fast, claiming the listing was a mistake. But the mall seems a shell of its former self these days. This week, contributor Eileen Delabrita takes a closer look at where things stand with Concord Mall and what could be next for it, as many malls around the country face extinction. And she joined me earlier this week to discuss what she learned. So let's start with that elephant in the room, or the mall, I guess, in this case. What is the deal with this recent sales listing for Concord Mall? What did it say, and what is its owner saying about it now?
Well, the mall's longtime leasing agent listed the mall for sale on its website, gave a price, $30 million. And then ownership said, nope, it's all a mistake, that it was posted an error, and it's since been taken down, and they apologize for any confusion.
So it does make you think that if even a mistaken listing was put up, that there's been some thought about selling it, right? I mean, that only makes sense.
That's my impression.
Fair enough. So let's talk about what's going on at the mall right now itself. Walking through the mall myself recently, I was struck by the number of vacancy, the lack of foot traffic during the holiday season. What can you tell us about the mall's relative retail health right now?
Well, we know that it has a 77% occupancy rate, which means its vacancies are more than twice as high as other malls in Concord's category. We also know that Sears, that big Sears store, has been dark for 5 years, and the mall's owners and management aren't in the driver's seat there. Sears Holding Company owns that store, and they ultimately call the shots.
So really just kind of in limbo right now with Sears and with all those vacancies. You spent some time at the mall this week like I did recently. You were talking to people about what's going on there. What did you hear from the people you talked about on the ground at the mall about what they're seeing and feeling about Concord Mall?
Well, the mall is clean and well lit. It doesn't look like it's about to fall down or anything. It's maintained. Shoppers say they love Chick-fil-A, where there is always a line, and they adore Boscov's. They just wish there were more stores.
Yeah, it seems like it is kind of lopsided, you know, on that Boscov side. There seems to be more activity, restaurants and such on the Boscov side than obviously down by the other end where the dark Sears store is. I guess that's part of the problem that they've got to try and figure out, right?
Yeah, and there's a new restaurant, Mex-a-Mex, very near Boscov's, down at that more popular end of the mall. Big restaurant, really nice bar. It's a nice place, and it was great to see.
So the mall seemed to be in trouble back in 2020 when it was sold to Namdar Realty Group, and by fall of 2022, you were reporting that it was boasting 80% occupancy. While moving away from national chains and trying to attract local retailers and non-traditional service providers, what can you tell us about what happened to that approach? Did that approach ultimately fail?
I wouldn't say that it's failed. One of the retailers that they had brought in from the shopping center that closed in Claymont was a furniture store, and that is no longer there. Like most malls, Concord was open to non-traditional tenants, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. For example, I saw that a small spa there is now closed.
So they're still just trying to find, I guess, the right mix or the right people to kind of take off in some of these vacancies.
I think so.
So we've seen other malls disappear or be sold and undergo major redevelopment. Among the more recent examples, Plymouth Meeting Mall over in Pennsylvania. What do those mall situations tell us about what could be next for Concord Mall?
Well, Plymouth Meeting and Berkshire Mall, both in Pennsylvania, were physically, at least, in much worse shape than Concord. That said, I think it just reinforces that there is a very strong trend of malls being redeveloped for other purposes, such as housing.
And that's something to certainly kind of keep an eye on. When you have that listing come up, that's, I guess, the immediate thought people have is like, okay, here's what's going to happen. They're going to sell it and something's going to be redeveloped. Is that kind of been the trend? Is it gets sold and then it gets redeveloped?
Yes. And there are, typically there is a small retail presence, but there will, you know, that it's such a bonus, I think, for developers to have a big chunk of land that a mall and all its parking typically encompass. So there's a lot of different stuff you can do with it.
So with that in mind, what are some of the pluses that Concord Mall would offer to a developer if they wanted to redevelop the Concord Mall site?
Well, it has a great location on Route 202, which, as we all know, is a very heavily trafficked road. And it's right, you know, in North Wilmington, which is an affluent area. And it is not far from the Pennsylvania border. So, and, you know, we don't charge sales tax here in Delaware. So those are some really significant pluses. Plus, as I mentioned before, just the, you know, it is, as far as I can tell, it is the largest contiguous property on Route 202. So having that big piece of real estate that is, you know, not a small lot, not a series of small lots, that's very attractive to developers.
Yeah, there's not a lot of opportunities like that available anywhere really in North Wilmington, right?
Absolutely.
So on the other side, what would be some of the impediments to the mall property being sold and then kind of reimagined?
Well, you know, we talked briefly about Sears, and you know, I think that it's a source of frustration for the people who live near the mall, and also for the people who are you know, have taken on the task of trying to bring back this mall, that you have this big anchor that is dark, and they don't really have any say over what happens to it. And also, there are, you know, there are anchors there, and anchors have a lot of power, typically long-term leases, or like Sears, they own their stores. And if they dig in their heels and they're doing well, they can really throw a wrench in the works.
Just for clarity's sake, can they sell Concord Mall before the Sears situation is resolved? Or what would that look like if they sold it and Sears was still kind of sitting there like, well, we're not ready to do anything?
You know, I don't know the specifics of their of what's going on with Sears, and in terms of what kind of say that they have over the rest of the property, but they definitely, you know, own theirs, and they have absolute sovereignty over that property, which is almost 200,000 square feet.
I was going to say, I mean, it's kind of hard to develop around that, and you wouldn't want to develop around a large empty store. I mean, that's not really viable for someone to redevelop until that's resolved, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know a lot of people who want to live next door to a vacant department store.
So as we wrap up, you know, your thoughts on, can we expect some resolution or movement on Concord Mall and what's next for it in the relatively near future? Does something kind of need to happen, or can it go on like this for a little while longer?
I think it can go on like this for a little while longer, but I don't think that it can go on like this for indefinitely. That they either need to find the mix of retailers. They're not having any national retailers sign on. A lot of them are still there, like Victoria's Secret and H&M, but they don't have new national retailers coming in because they're going away from mall-based stores. So I think that something dramatic needs to happen, but I'm not quite sure what that is.
Yeah, I guess that the longer it goes on like this, there's a greater likelihood that the H&Ms of the world, or the Children's Place that's still there, the national outlets would maybe at some point give up and leave, which could really cripple them if they don't do something before that.
Yeah, when these leases are up, these national retailers are leaving the malls that aren't really great. I mean, Christiana is a power center, and it's always, if not 100% leased, almost 100% leased. But there aren't many malls left like that anymore, which is why these retailers are moving away when their lease is up.
Thanks to contributor Eileen Dalabrida for joining us on The Green this week. A reminder, her piece on Concord Mall and its future is available at DelawarePublic.org. Up next, we hear from the Delaware HIV Consortium about its work to help those living with HIV in the first state. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The bulk of HIV prevention and support services in the nation are funded through the federal government. Delaware is no different. And the first state has seen a 55% reduction in federal funding for HIV prevention services since 2023. Experts say if the government doesn't fund the public health sector, the U.S. will see a rise in HIV. Cutting corners won't save the country or the state of Delaware money either. In Delaware, lifelong treatment for HIV costs about $550,000. This week, Delaware Public Media's Abigail Lee sits down with Delaware HIV Consortium Executive Director Tyler Burrell to talk about HIV in the first state and the consortium's next steps, with or without federal funding.
As of the end of November, there were roughly 4,200 people in Delaware living with HIV. This is still a disease that largely impacts urban areas. So roughly, 60% of the population of people living with HIV reside in Newcastle County or the greater Wilmington area. But like I said, it does impact every zip code and area across the state. Right now, we are seeing, there's roughly 22% of people who reside in Delaware are African American, but roughly 55 or 60% of the population of people living with HIV in Delaware are African American or Black. We also know at this point that a lot of people living with HIV are aging with the disease. And so we're seeing a bulge in people over the age of 50 who are aging with HIV. And so we need to be concerned about, aging services as well for this population. They are your neighbors, your friends. And I'm sure that you know somebody who's living with HIV, even though they might not have told you. Roughly, though, it is a disease that adversely impacts marginalized populations, African-American community, low-income communities, Haitian and Creole populations, injection drug users, and largely in the LGBTQ or men who have sex with men area. HIV now is no longer a death sentence. If you're diagnosed with HIV and you are on your treatments, you can live effectively a full life. And you can also not pass the disease or the virus on to other people through your everyday activities. But the challenge is that there is limited access to care, limited testing here in Delaware, and we're seeing a rise in HIV. It is not a disease that is ended, and we need to now provide the additional attention and scrutiny to make sure that we work to continue to end the HIV epidemic here in Delaware.
And what would that look like? What would that take?
Sure. The first challenge is always making sure that everyone is tested for HIV. We know that public support and public funding for HIV, both on the prevention and care side, has been largely reduced over the last handful of years. And as an effect of that, there's no longer adequate coverage of HIV testing or prevention services in the communities across the state of Delaware. We also know that because of those limited access to the public health side of this, then we're seeing a vast rise in HIV diagnosis here in Delaware. So since the early 2020s, we've seen roughly a 30% rise in annual HIV diagnosis in Delaware. When we have all of the tools to effectively end HIV, either through testing or safe sex supplies or daily prescriptions to make sure that you can stay HIV negative. And then, you know, the last piece of that is people living with HIV, the biggest indicator of someone remaining in access to HIV healthcare is providing affordable housing. We know that there's a housing affordability challenge here in Delaware. We also know that there's limited access to HIV healthcare as well. And so we know that we need to support those modalities across the board.
I know that from the consortium's annual report, about 92% of spending went to services. Can you talk a little bit about what kinds of services that includes?
The Delaware HIV Consortium was founded in 1991. We were formed initially as a community convener, working to bring all the state's stakeholders together in the HIV space to draft the state's strategic plans for ending the HIV epidemic. But in our 35-year history, we've grown into a diverse service provider and comprehensive service provider as well. So on the prevention side, we do HIV testing and testing for other diseases such as hepatitis C. We also do a condom distribution program and safe sex supply distribution program. We also have a new program in 2025, which is providing people with access to pre-exposure prophylaxis or PrEP, which is a pill that, or injection that you can take daily or regularly that if taken appropriately or will make sure that you stay HIV negative. On the care side, for people living with HIV, we have a comprehensive set of services as well. Case management program that serves roughly 400 Delawareans or a tenth of the persons diagnosed with HIV through case management. We have a very comprehensive housing assistance program that pays rental assistance to roughly 125 households per month to make sure that they stay in stable and safe housing. We also offer emergency financial assistance for people who are hit with unexpected utilities or rental bills that they cannot pay for through other means. And we also, which has become newly important to us, a comprehensive emergency hygiene and emergency food pantry program as well. Additionally, we still do advocacy and education type of work to make sure that the community is aware of the needs of this population.
So with rental and copay assistance, the consortium has a holistic care kind of model. Why is that rather than just focusing on things like case management and testing?
We know that the biggest driver of HIV health outcomes is access to safe and affordable housing. Generally, we find that if people do not have a safe place to call home, then they can't pay attention to their health care. Or taking their prescriptions that keep them their HIV at bay or healthy. On the flip side, our other largest program is a prescription program that we operate, which helps to pay for the prescriptions and co-pays for clients living with HIV to access their both HIV medications, but also their other healthcare medications as well. And so, again, roughly a quarter of our budget goes to housing, roughly a quarter of our budget goes to prescriptions. We know that if we can support people's rental costs per month and they stay stably housed, then they're more likely to go to their doctor, more likely to go to their case manager, and more likely to be taking care of their other social determinants of health that impact their health overall.
Shifting into a different aspect, the federal landscape for HIV prevention and support has changed over the last year, over the last 5 years even. This year, the Trump administration canceled grants related to HIV research, and the bulk of prevention, treatment, and support services comes from federal funding. Can you talk a little bit about what that looks like for the consortium and how that's playing out for you?
I think it's worth reflecting that HIV knows no party affiliation. And we've also seen a rise in annual HIV diagnosis here in Delaware in both Republican and Democratic administrations over the last 4 or 5 years as well. But we are seeing major stressors at this point, both across our entire public health landscape in Delaware, but in particular in the HIV public health and risk reduction and prevention space. Since 2023, we've seen roughly a 55% reduction in public funds that go from the federal government to the state of Delaware for HIV prevention services. And that has had major impacts on both the government public health system, but also on community-based providers like ours in how we address the HIV response. We also are very adamantly aware that if we are not resourcing our public health sector, then we will see a rise in HIV. And it's going to cost the state of Delaware and the federal government money on the back end. We know that in Delaware, every person diagnosed with HIV has roughly a lifetime treatment cost of $550,000 to address their HIV healthcare throughout their lifetime. And so we know that if we don't resource our public health system now, then we'll have to pay for it on the back end.
At the end of the consortium's annual report, there's a line that says, quote, "The DHC faced a sharp reduction in state prevention funding, but shows stability over retreat, protecting essential staff and preserving community services." How have funding cuts reshaped the organization?
Over the last 2 years, we've seen a reduction in our state contracts by roughly a quarter million dollars annually for HIV prevention services. And we are walking into 2026 with actually $0 in public contracts for HIV prevention moving forward. And so it's been 2 years now that we are trying to find new sustainable funding and service models to resource our prevention department. As an agency, it is our priority, it is our awareness and our commitment that we cannot end the HIV epidemic unless we prevent new HIV diagnoses. But now we're trying to figure out how to do it in other ways, and we haven't found a sustainable solution to that as of yet. And so what that has meant is we've seen a reduction in staffing in the department we've had to cut two or three prevention specialists and reduce the number of services that we can provide in the community while trying to be here in our offices and in the community as much as possible to make sure that people who have needs, who have to protect themselves from HIV, were available to them.
You said some of the cuts started in 2023. That was during the Biden administration. Do you see these funding cuts as a largely conservative move, or is that happening across party lines?
I would say that, again, HIV knows no political stripes, that we've seen a under-resourcing of public health systems, both at the federal and local levels under current administrations who deal with financial pressures now. They don't see the positive benefits of public health preventing disease in the future. And that has left public health systems weak and fragile. I would say that the current federal attitude to the HIV epidemic and a lot of the stakeholders or populations that we deal with have been antagonistic and unhelpful, and it could lead to, adverse challenges in people's lives impacted in the future that we are concerned about.
The new year starts in just a couple weeks. Where's the consortium at for next year? What does next year look like?
We are always in the planning phase for the organization. We are wrapping up a strategic planning process as we speak, and so we definitely see future threats down the line for access to care. So, what are we doing as an organization? We are thinking about other funding models and program income that we have to support and diversify away from government funding. So we know that we'll see expansions of our prescription programs that we offer and operate to support both people living with HIV, but the organization. We are also going to be stepping out in a major way in advocacy, in our leadership in the advocacy space, to make sure our local, state, and federal elected officials are aware that HIV has not ended, and that the public health system is fragile and needs to be supported now and in the future. So that's what we're doing in 2026. We are always concerned that there's not going to be enough revenue to meet the needs of our populations, but we are trying to systematically and strategically address those to make sure that we are here strong and available as experts as the need continues in the future and evolves in the future.
Thanks to Delaware HIV Consortium Executive Director Tyler Burrow and our Abigail Lee for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, Arts Playlist and a conversation with Hagley Museum Executive Director Jill McKenzie as she prepares to retire next year. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. After a 44-year-long career at Wilmington's Hagley Museum and Library, Jill McKenzie is stepping down as the museum's executive director. On this installment of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny sits down with McKenzie to talk about her career, the museum, and the future of the humanities.
Let me start by asking, you've been with Hagley for 44 years, and before we talk about your career, I want to start by asking you about your pre-Hagley life. What brought you to the point where you started working there?
Well, I am actually a Jersey girl. I was born and raised in New Jersey and came to the University of Delaware and just really fell in love with the state of Delaware. It's so different than New Jersey, and I decided that I wanted to stay here. So one of the first jobs that I had post-graduation was at the Delaware Art Museum. And I realized just how incredible the cultural organizations in this state are. I mean, for those who haven't visited the Delaware Art Museum, it has some of the most incredible collections that really are international in their scope, between the, you know, the Howard Pyles and the Brandywine School of Illustration, as well as the Pre-Raphaelites. So I fell in love with art and art history at that time, and was looking to continue in public relations, which is what I had majored in college, and the position at Hagley became open, and that's when I came here.
Let's talk a little bit about your career at the Hagley. You started in public relations. Take me through your life there.
Well, you know, public relations is in many ways a catch-all for the work that we do to bring Hagley, the museum, and the library to the public. And so as my career with Hagley evolved, the position grew to include more public affairs. And, you know, I was very lucky in that I was able to take on more responsibility over the years. And after 10 years of working in external affairs, I was asked if I would head up the development department. So I became the head of external affairs and development. And I think for any career in a nonprofit, you have to understand the people who are supporting you, you know, your donors, and how to interact with them, because it truly is in engagement with your donors, and you find out what their interests are, that people will then want to support the institution. And so that was a real learning experience for me, because I had never done fundraising prior to that.
How has the museum and library grown and evolved over your time there?
Well, you know, it's funny, knowing that I was going to be talking with you today, I really kind of reflected on that. And when I first started at Hagley, we were describing ourselves as an industrial village. And I thought, well, that doesn't sound like a whole lot of fun. So we started to shift to more like telling the story of where the DuPont story began, and the workers' lives, and the original DuPont Mills estate and gardens. And since that time, we've really, I think, looked at what Hagley's niche is in this area in the Brandywine Valley. And one of the things that we have, of course, is the Brandywine River. But we're also a mechanical engineering landmark site. We've got the machinery. And so it started to evolve into a place where we could showcase what we have, but talk about how the DuPont company and the DuPont family were innovators. And so that's where our mission is now, is that we are working to inspire people to be innovative in their own lives through all the things that we do at Hagley and also online.
Over your career, you must have so many memorable moments, but what are some of the most memorable experiences that stand out to you?
I think one of the most was about 10 years ago, we were so fortunate to acquire a large collection of United States patent models. And the patent models were things that the patent office required between 1790 and 1880. And these were small models of invention that an inventor needed to submit in order to show the patent examiner what it was that they wanted to patent. And so we got a collection of approximately 5,000 of them that joined the 800 or so that we had. And it allowed us to now think large about the role of invention in this country. So our exhibit is on two floors of our visitor center, and it's a new gateway to the institution. So when people come here, they get the sense that, yes, there were a lot of famous people and a lot of people who made money by inventing, but the vast majority of people who invent in our country are not famous. And they may not be making huge amounts of money, but they had an idea, and it's something that they wanted to pursue.
I want to ask sort of a present day question, too, because of your experience in this field. I feel like I would be remiss if I didn't ask you. The last year especially has seen huge cuts to federal funding for humanities and arts. It's a different time now, it feels like, and I wonder, what should museums and humanities organizations do to stay healthy and kind of weather the storm?
Thankfully, when the cuts happened from the federal government, we didn't have a lot of outstanding federal money that was owed us. So from that perspective, we were a little bit lucky. But I think overall, you know, for nonprofits, for cultural institutions, there are so many demands on people's time and donations. And so I think we've all been affected by that. And so we're reaching out to our donors just to say, hey, you know, please remember us, because the work that we do is for the betterment of our community. We are giving back to the community with every dollar that's given to us in some way. And so we encourage people to think about all of our cultural institutions, because in so many ways, we are what makes a community vibrant and full of life and full of the things that I think lift all of us up.
What makes Hagley so special to you just personally?
I think because there's no other place like it that I've ever found, this balance between this incredibly beautiful site. We're 235 acres along the river, so we've got historic landscape, we've got historic buildings, and over time, you know, what we've seen is how things change. In many ways, they stay the same. Like, our dams are still so important today. One of the things that people don't realize is that we have an electric shuttle that we actually power by the water of the Brandywine. So there are these aha moments that we provide for our visitors. But I think in many ways, it's also the fact that we're constantly thinking about the future and the lessons that we're learning today that we can help others begin to understand, so that they can think about the implications for their own lives. You know, when you see kids here on a school tour and all of a sudden things click in their mind and you see that light bulb go off in their eyes and their eyes get big. I mean, there's no other experience in the world like that.
Your successor is going to have some huge shoes to fill. And I know the search process is underway, but what qualities make for a good executive director?
Well, you know what, I think at the top of the list is probably curiosity. You know, that every day that I've been here at Hagley, I feel that I have learned something because I'm open to listening to staff and digging in the archives. And it's because I'm a curious person. And, you know, so I think that will serve them really well. But I think in today's day and age, you know, nonprofits, we understand that nonprofits are businesses. You know, we may not have shareholders, but we certainly have a lot of stakeholders. And so it's got to be someone who understands how nonprofits operate and appreciate the staff and our visitors and our donors. And I'm sure that that's what our search committee is going to be looking for.
What advice do you have for young people, maybe in high school or college, who have a love for this particular field, for museum work, for curation, and want to pursue it as a career? What would you tell them?
Well, one of the best things that we have at Hagley is our volunteer program. And our teen volunteers are such an integral part of that, because kids relate really well to their peers. And if you get someone who's just a little bit older, you know, it truly is that person that they're looking up to as opposed to maybe an adult. So I think for people who would like to potentially have a career working in a museum or a garden, volunteer. It's a great way to get to know your local cultural institutions.
And finally, what's next for you?
Well, you know, people are like, Jill, you have to have a plan when you retire. And I think for me, because my life has been so structured and so planned for the last 44 years, it's actually going to be to learn how to be a little more spontaneous and to be able to just on a whim pick up and see my friends, see my sisters. I just look forward to being a visitor in museums as opposed to being one of the ones in charge.
Well, thank you so much, Jill, for your time. Best of luck with the next step, however spontaneous and unplanned it might be.
Martin, thank you so much. And again, to everyone who's listening in, you know, it's a special time of the year. I hope that everyone gets out and gets to enjoy their cultural resources in the community.
Thanks to Hagley Museum and Library Executive Director Jill McKenzie and our Martin Matheny for joining us on Arts Playlist. McKenzie wraps up her 44-year career with the museum when she retires in June. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me, where we learn about a breakthrough at ChristianaCare's Gene Editing Institute that can help with lung cancer treatment. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Researchers at ChristianaCare's Gene Editing Institute make a breakthrough in lung cancer care. The breakthrough reverses chemotherapy resistance, and the hope is this research will help develop the same results for other cancers in the future. In this edition of Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Joey Arizari talks with Kelly Bannis, lead author of this study and associate director of research at the ChristianaCare Gene Editing Institute, about the importance of the findings and what might come next.
Can you describe the breakthrough that was achieved by the ChristianaCare Gene Editing Institute?
Yeah, of course. So we've been working on developing a CRISPR-based gene editing system to augment standard of care therapy for patients. And so our recent research has come out over work that we've done over the last several years, really understanding what drives treatment resistance in patients. And our research has really honed in on a gene known as NRF2, which is a master regulator of cellular stress response. And so when NRF2 is overactive in cancer cells, it helps to really help the cancer cells withstand chemotherapy. And so what we have been working on understanding is how we can use CRISPR to really augment standard of care for patients. So what we saw was that by using CRISPR-directed gene editing to target NRF2, we can really disrupt treatment resistance within lung cancer cells. And this has really spearheaded us into understanding how this works preclinically. And now we're moving into conversations of clinical trials.
Before we move on, you mentioned CRISPR a few times. So what is that exactly?
Yes, correct. So CRISPR is a gene editing molecule. It is a breakthrough technology that really came out in the scientific community and into the spotlight back in 2015. It is a specific tool that allows us to target DNA very precisely and specifically. So it allows us to create a double-stranded break within human cells in a very specific location, disrupting genes. And it's been used across a variety of applications, biotech, agriculture, healthcare, and there are many different applications for this. So we are particularly using this to create a double-stranded break, allow the gene or allow the cell to repair itself. And this usually causes a disruption of the gene. So in our case, we're knocking out NRF2, which is an oncogene, causing a disruption in cancer cells. So through this mechanism, we're able to really disrupt these pathways that cause cancer.
Now, I can't imagine this was a simple study. I mean, it it's for me, all science is not simple. So I just to get that out there. But how many different levels were there before you achieved this breakthrough?
Yeah, so we've been working on this particular gene using CRISPR for going on almost 10 years. Our first seminal publication came out in 2018, really identifying NRF2 as a driver in treatment resistance. And there we did some preliminary in vitro cell-based studies, as well as some initial proof of principle animal studies. And ever since then, we've been really working to understand how this CRISPR works in the cells and understanding how we can use CRISPR to move this into a more patient-based application. So since our work in 2018, we've been really working to understand how we can now deliver CRISPR to the patient. So in this recent publication, we used a non-viral based approach. So we were using lipid nanoparticles to deliver our CRISPR molecule of interest into tumor cells within an animal model. So we really kind of went from working to understand the molecular mechanisms behind using CRISPR to now really tying this together into a proof of concept study that really serves to mimic what a patient clinical trial might potentially look like.
Reversing chemotherapy resistance in lung cancer, what does this mean in the big picture here?
Yes. Yeah, so lung cancer continues to be one of the leading causes of cancer-related death globally. And a lot of these patients are faced with very limited options. If they undergo treatments, whether it's chemotherapy, radiation, immunotherapy, many times they develop resistance along the way and are left with a very dismal progression-free survival. What we've come to understand is that NRF2 is really a key driver here within treatment resistance. So what we're trying to do is really use existing approaches. So in this case, using gene editing with a known treatment resistance driver, really to make current standard of care work better. So we're not trying to reinvent the wheel here. We're trying to use what's already out there and really to help patients become more responsive to chemotherapy.
Moving forward, does this open up the possibility to do the same for other cancers?
Yes. So we have been working very diligently to understand this gene, NRF2, and how we can apply CRISPR. And what we found is that really this is a platform-based approach. So we see that in our publication that recently came out, we're looking at a tumor-specific mutation that drives resistance. But currently in the works, we're looking at a more universal-based approach. So how can we target NRF2 that is maybe mutated in different avenues or maybe overly abundant in different ways? So we're currently working in collaboration with Corexor Therapeutics to really drive this forward into a more platform-based approach. We're looking at cancers like head and neck, squamous cell carcinoma, esophageal, pancreatic, liver. So the approach itself has great application across many different tumor types, and we hope to reach more patients.
Is the hope that you already got this started with lung cancer therapy that it can maybe be quicker once you get to other cancers, or is this, you don't know? I mean, this is just going to be a wait and see approach here, and then you can figure it out.
Yeah, great question. We are hopeful that this will be able to be applied broadly across the different cancer types. What we see is some of the challenges with bringing this forward into a clinical trial is really the delivery of our molecule. So we know our therapy works really well, and we've got great data to support this approach. It really comes down to now, how are we going to get this CRISPR to patients? And so with our lung cancer work, we see delivery as being a little bit challenging because the lung is a very specific organ, but the field has really worked to understand how to deliver drugs and therapeutics to the lung in collaboration with Corexor Therapeutics. They just announced collaboration with Merckxin and InhaTarget, which are companies working on inhaled delivery. And so we hope to partner with them to really push forward our clinical, preclinical work and make this more attainable for lung cancer patients. Now, for head and neck cancer patients, their tumors are a little bit more readily accessible. So we're looking at more intratumoral direct delivery. And we really hope that this really creates a platform-based approach for us. So once we understand how this may work in a cancer type, we will be able to move this forward and open this up to a more broad-based population of cancer patients.
Throughout this process, was there ever a time where you were just like, this may not happen? Or was there always a progression there that made you feel like, okay, we're getting there, we're getting there, we're getting there? You saw the light at the end of the tunnel. I mean, how did that go?
Yeah, I think the field has been rapidly progressing and changing ever since we really started our journey back in 2018. So I think with credit to the rest of the field and gene editing and the other great scientists moving this forward and all the support scientists in the scientific community to really find new approaches and innovative technologies for cancer treatment, I think it's really been a collaborative nature and spirit. So we've always had some light at the end of the tunnel. There's never been really a time where we've doubted ourselves. The scientific community has always stepped forward and had a new novel approach to bringing this forward to patients. And what we've seen through our various collaborations, it really is the people around you who make the science better. So we're very fortunate to have great partners through Corixor Therapeutics and their network to really drive this forward and keep that light at the end of the tunnel for us, but also for cancer patients and what those treatments might mean for cancer patients.
How important is this, again, big picture, in the fight against cancer? Or is it just like another piece of a very complex puzzle?
Great question. It's a very complex piece of the puzzle for sure. But I believe that our work really lays the foundation for at least starting the conversation for cancer patients. It seems that the cancer population, cancer patients seem to be left out a little bit from the CRISPR conversation and applications of using CRISPR. And we're really spearheading this here at Christiana Care at the Gene Editing Institute. We have a patient-first approach, and we recognized through our work and interactions with the Helen F. Graham Cancer Center that these patients need a voice and need options, particularly transformative, innovative options outside of what is readily available. And so we're really working to bring that forward to cancer patients and be that voice for these patients who may not have any other option at the end of the line of their treatment regimen. So we've been working diligently to really be that voice for these patients through Christiana Care and the values that they bring forward as our institute.
Thanks to Christiana Care Gene Editing Institute Associate Director of Research, Kelly Bannis, and our Joe Irizarry for enlightening us this week. And that's all we have time for on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible. Contributor Eileen Dalabrida, Delaware Public Media's Joe Irizarry, Abigail Lee, and Martin Matheny. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week. The Green is taking some time off during the holidays. We'll be back again in the new year, returning Friday, January 9th. Until then, happy holidays from all of us here at The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.